Chapter 2.
The Desert Jewel entered the atmosphere of Rhodia without earning a scrambled visit from a squadron of TIE fighters. Following a route painted by R2, I dropped down on the coast of B2, a continent away from the Chatsa clan, the Grand Protector, and the bulk of Imperial activity. The Chekku clan lived there, and while they weren't in open rebellion, lacking the resources to follow their hearts, simple geography gave them the opportunity to exercise some passive resistance and keep a few secrets. Set upon a high, rocky cliffside with ocean waves pounding the base, the Chekku enclave sported a single great tower thrust out of a series of stone walls draped around it like skirts, each one bristling with weapons emplacements. A thriving city nestled in between the walls, but the spaceport waited outside them, and we touched down there. Beyond that, the jungle awaited, humid and humming with the drone of insects and the occasional screech of something wanting to eat, or something else dismayed at being eaten. I wasn't prepared for the smell. A diplomatic person would say it was pungent. I couldn't muster any words, diplomatic or otherwise. It was all I could do not to gag openly as the ramp opened and the odor of bad cheese and fungal feet wafted in, hot and cloying and fat in my nostrils, much too big for the space, like a hut squeezed into an armchair. A single Rhodian waited for me at the bottom of the ramp and pretended not to notice my expression of disgust. She was dressed in a long blue tunic edged in gold and matching pants tucked into buckled brown boots. She had a spray of golden spines sticking up between her antennae and falling in a line down the back of her head.
"Welcome, Luke Skywalker," she said. "I am Lanit Chekku. I'll be your guide while you visit Rhodia."
"Pleasure to meet you," I managed. "Are you only a guide, or will I be negotiating with you as well?"
"Only a guide. I am primarily concerned with keeping your presence here unobserved by other clans. If you will follow me, we will depart for Tupil."
"Tupil? Aren't we going to the Enclave?" Lanit twitched her head once to the left, which I believe signaled negative among Rhodians.
"Too many Imperial spies there, and even more from other clans. At the Enclave we are meek and subservient to the Grand Protector, and display very little in the way of our true wealth and power. Tupil is a different place entirely. You will see. This way, please."
I followed Lanit out of the relatively quiet spaceport and into a teeming open-air market, with labyrinthine passages and a shifting crowd of shoppers unconscious of personal space. A whole new spectrum of smells hammered my nose. Some of it was supposed to be appetizing, I think, since I spied food vendors, but it wasn't making me hungry at all. R2's dome swiveled about as he trailed behind, taking it all in, but he kept silent. We made several turns before ducking into an electronics vendor boasting of aftermarket jamming systems and other fine accessories for the discriminating bounty hunter. The vendor's stall turned out not to be a stall at all, but its own maze of a structure with multiple levels and merchandise grouped in small rooms, each with its own resident merchant and with multiple exits to other showrooms. When we rounded a corner into a room displaying racks of neural disruptors and occupied only by a giant Ithorian, Lanit signaled with her right hand, and the Ithorian lumbered forward to block the narrow passage behind us with its bulk. No one would be able to squeeze past it until it reemerged, and we took the opportunity this afforded to slip into a hallway concealed behind a wall panel, filled with weapons that might have been designed to melt internal organs. Once the panel closed behind R2, Lanit paused in the dimly lit passage and looked back at us.
"We just want to make sure we are not followed. Our transport awaits ahead. But please, move silently. We are still moving through the market, and the walls are thin. We don't want to give away the presence of this passage to anyone.
I nodded and trailed after our guide in near darkness, the only illumination coming from wan glow panels spaced in intervals that were farther apart than was comfortable for human eyesight. Sounds of the bazaar trickled through the walls on either side. Merchants haggling with customers or bawling out specials to passers-by in the hope of attracting a full purse. Eventually, we reached the end of the passage, where two armed guards and a gauntlet of automatic guns in the walls trained their weapons on us. Lynette identified herself and introduced us, and after some unseen processing behind all the weaponry, we were allowed to pass and descend a ramp to a small docking platform where a personnel speeder waited at the entrance to a subterranean tunnel. We piled in, and Lynette fired up the repulsors, rocketing down the tunnel for maybe 10 minutes.
"We can talk now," she said. "Please forgive the unpleasant security measures. We welcome all business, you understand, especially that which will prove inconvenient to the Chatzak clan or the Empire. But we must be careful. It is for our protection, as much as yours, that we go to such lengths."
"Well, it's impressive. I've never even heard of Tupil," I said.
"It doesn't exist officially,"
Lynette replied.
"It's simply a cantina, a few meeting rooms, and some sleeping arrangements underneath Uthiel Outfitters. Uthiel makes everything from stealth armor to big-game grenade launchers, and they test their products in the surrounding jungle. They invite prospective customers out for hunts, and thus they have dormitories on site for the purpose. But underneath those are secret dormitories, accessible only through a few well-guarded entry points like the one we used. Energy usage is thereby concealed. We also have a private docking bay and smuggler's den with an entrance camouflaged from the air. Most light freighters would fit in there. We do plenty of business in that bay. All of it hidden from the Empire and other clans. And the money is laundered through Uthiel Outfitters."
I thought Han would be impressed with their setup. I sure was. "And the Empire truly has no clue you're doing this?" Lynette snorted in derision, which sounded like a phlegmy sneeze through the Rhodian snout.
"I'm sure they have their suspicions. We suspect every other clan of similar practices."
We arrived at a dock that appeared at first to be unguarded, but I sensed somehow that wasn't the case. After all the security I saw getting this far, I couldn't imagine they'd leave this wide open. Lynette caught my expression and interpreted it correctly.
"There are guards. They're in stealth armor."
"Oh, really? I've never seen stealth armor." Lynette made a noise similar to a chortle, but closer to a digestive problem.
"Hence the name."
It reminded me of Ben's assertion that your eyes can deceive you. The Force would help me pierce through such illusions, if I could learn how. "Do you manufacture the stealth armor yourself?"
"Yes. Uthiel is quite diversified. It doesn't have shipyards or produce heavy artillery, but almost anything smaller can be found here. Save, perhaps, blasters. Other manufacturers are more efficient at producing such basic weapons. We produce a broad range of higher quality items in smaller batches. You will see more inside. Come."
We stepped out of the speeder and onto an empty concrete dock, with a single door waiting at the back of a concavity lined with automatic blaster turrets and presumably the aforementioned guards in stealth armor. With so much firepower concentrated here, I wondered if even a Jedi could make it to the door unscathed. No one would penetrate it without fully committing to heavy assault. Lanit paused at the door, spoke some words at a console, had her hands and eyes scanned, and the door chimed as it opened. I followed after. Once through the door, we found ourselves in a small, magnetically sealed room. Lanit pointed first at the floor, where there was some discoloration, and then at the ceiling, where there were matching stains.
If anyone were to get this far without receiving a go-ahead from the door outside, the weighted ceiling drops down quite fast. Squashed at least one Chatsa spy.
The inner door chimed before opening, and a narrow hall provided more opportunities for defense before finally leading us to a rather luxurious meeting room, sporting tables surrounded by thickly upholstered chairs. The room was carpeted and chandeliered, and attended by liveried servants rather than droids. Even the tablecloths looked posh. I got the impression the Rhodians had gone to some effort to make it smell pleasant to humans, but the competing scents of Rhodians and florals made the air difficult to breathe. Several Rhodians waited to be introduced, all employees from different divisions of Uthiel Outfitters, ready to discuss what business they could with the representative of the Rebel Alliance. And I admit, I found that thought enjoyable. Leaving aside the odor, this sort of work was much more entertaining than moisture farming. Long tables lined the perimeter of the room, laid out with weapons instead of a buffet. After a drink and a brief chat during which I complimented the Chekku security arrangements I'd seen thus far, they gave me a tour of the weapons, some of them prototypes, and several of these were presented as gifts. I got a proximity stun mine, a handheld EMP detonator, and a needle gun I never intended to use. Thinking of Nakari's slug gun, however, and her assertion that it would work in situations where blasters might not, I asked if they might have anything with that kind of punch behind it, something with high-velocity armor-piercing rounds. One of the weapons engineers said he could secure something for me to look at the next day. If it wouldn't be too much trouble, I'd like to see the smuggling bay that Lanit mentioned earlier before we make any deals. Your equipment is fine, but it will be useless if we can't get it off planet safely. They agreed that would be best, and as it was getting on toward planetary nightfall and the end of their shift, they said Lanit would take me to the bay and they'd continue with me the next day. R2 and I followed Lanit into a busy cargo bay located underneath Uthiel Outfitters, but on the opposite side of the dock from where we had entered. There we took another speeder, a few clicks down a much wider tunnel, until we reached a giant lift suitable for loading large pallets or even vehicles. Lanit drove the speeder directly into the lift, and we took it up to a large cavern carved out of the rock. Lanit pressed a single button to activate a sliding door, which opened up a slice of cliffside in a narrow canyon. The other side loomed above, already cast in shadow under clouds painted pink from the setting sun, and Lanit led us to the edge and pointed up.
We are low enough that the lip of the other side provides a shadow from satellite surveillance. You would enter and exit the canyon from that direction, she said, gesturing to the left. Follow it to the end, and you will emerge at a waterfall that is something of a tourist destination just 10 clicks from the spaceport near the Enclave. Its beauty is reason enough for ships to visit, and no one thinks anything of the occasional traffic coming in and out.
Huh. Not much here, I said, looking around at the empty cavern.
It's for loading and unloading cargo only. We keep it powered off during downtime to prevent it being scanned. And we patrol the perimeter during operations to make sure no one can do a flyby and see it. Should you need rest and relaxation or refueling, all those facilities await at the spaceport. This was designed for discretion.
I gave a nod of appreciation. Yeah, I think this will work for us. All right, we can go back and start thinking about doing some business.
Excellent. I will inform Sunta. May I tell her you will join her for breakfast in the morning?
Sure. Lenit referred to Tanich Sunta, one of the Rhodians I'd met earlier. I believe she introduced herself as a sales executive for Uthiel Outfitters. As we walked back to the lift and Lenit closed the cavern wall with another push of the button, she said,
I'll take you to your room now in Tupil. Do you have all you require?
Almost. Just need a power feed for my droid and maybe some dinner.
Of course. And your droid can download our inventory and pricing for you to peruse at your leisure.
My room in the secret complex of Tupil proved to be my favorite place so far on Rhodia, for it had been scrubbed of smells as much as possible, rather than doused with a surplus of perfumes. R2 displayed the weapons and armor inventory after he downloaded it, and I frowned at the prices. I didn't precisely know the state of Alliance funding, but I wasn't sure we'd be able to afford any large orders. War was expensive, and not just in lives lost. I'd make a point of testing out the weapons tomorrow to make sure they deserved such a steep price. I left R2 in the room when it was time to meet with Sunta for breakfast. Lenit knocked softly on my door and led me upstairs to a special chamber of the Uthiel Outfitters complex. It was a solarium that also functioned as a cafe, though there weren't any families dining there. It appeared reserved for an exclusive clientele. Richly dressed Rhodians and an assortment of other species held quiet conversations, barely audible against the notes of a Bith symphony floating above them via hidden speakers. Sunlight filtered through a huge stained-glass window that reached from floor to ceiling, bathing all the diners in colored light. White porcelain cups and saucers rested in front of us on a small round bistro table. Each cup tinted a different hue thanks to the windows. I was wearing white also, but Sunta had dressed herself in an ensemble of dark greens, highlighted with glints of silver thread. Diners at other tables kept their voices low, their conversations amounting to no more than a soft hum over the Bith music. And I wondered if maybe that incredible window was responsible for creating the strange atmosphere of reverence. The other visitors sitting with Rhodians were no doubt as interested in Chekku weapons as the Alliance was. And it struck me as weird for everyone to be negotiating the purchase of deadly weapons in such a serene setting. This kind of commerce normally involved a certain seediness that the Rhodians were deliberately refusing to provide. After our server departed with our orders, and Sunta inquired politely about my sleep, I expected her to ask if I'd had the opportunity to review their catalog and suggest a discounted selection or something of that nature. She surprised me.
"Forgive me if I'm intruding, friend Skywalker," she said. "But I noticed something unusual as you sat down. A flash only, obviously not meant to be seen, but so interesting that I cannot help but ask, at risk of giving offense. Are you perhaps carrying a lightsaber?"
I froze. My lightsaber was indeed concealed beneath my outer tunic, but clearly I had not taken enough care in dressing this morning to make sure it stayed hidden. I didn't like to leave it lying around to be discovered when I was away, and so kept it on my person at all times. Though it wasn't a strictly prohibited weapon, its association with the Jedi would tend to make one guilty by association in the eyes of the Empire. The Chekku's willingness to conduct some business on the side with a rebellion might not extend to consorting with a sympathizer of the Jedi. We were stepping lightly on quicksand here. "That's an interesting question," I replied carefully. "Let us suppose, purely for argument's sake, that I am. Would you be offended or scandalized, or perhaps feel bound to report me to Imperial authorities?"
"Far from it, far from it," she assured me. I would have to confess that my views on the Jedi do not align with the official Imperial view.
Is that so? What are your views, then?
I can hardly give them words. I suppose I harbor doubts about the Empire's version of recent events. The victor's view of history rarely matches that of the vanquished, after all.
So you don't believe that the Jedi betrayed the Emperor?
I believe they had a serious disagreement with him, no doubt. And I find it easy to believe that he personally felt betrayed. His public behavior and rhetoric paint him to be the sort of man who views any disagreement as a betrayal. But I do not feel the Jedi were in the habit of betraying others. I believe they were more likely to keep oaths than break them. Of course, I have no proof of any of this. It is a feeling, nothing more.
That's an extraordinary feeling, if you don't mind me saying. How did you come to hold it? I asked.
A member of our clan was a Jedi Knight. He was my uncle, in fact. And though his devotion to the Order usually kept him far from Rhodia, I saw him a few times when I was young. Of course, he was here on Jedi business. And, of course, the Jedi do not maintain their family ties. But I was told who he was, and even had occasion to meet him once or twice. He seemed to me the very personification of honor.
I could relate to that feeling, because Ben Kenobi had affected me the same way. He was in my life for only a short time, yet he earned my trust and respect immediately. Even though, from a logical standpoint, I had little reason to trust a stranger. Now, meeting someone else who had personally known a Jedi Knight, I found it hard to hide my excitement. But instead of shouting, "No way! Tell me everything!" I carefully schooled my expression into a polite smile and said, "That's fascinating, Sunta. If you don't mind me asking, what was he like, apart from honorable?"
"His name was Ha'ulik. He was a good pilot, or at least fairly proud of his skills. But he used to talk about another Jedi who could fly like no other. And his name also happened to be Skywalker. That's why that fleeting glimpse of a lightsaber piqued my interest. I don't suppose you had any relatives among the Jedi?"
My heart pumped faster. "Yes, my father was a Jedi who fought in the Clone Wars." Sunta blinked and tilted her head.
"A son of a Jedi Knight? I thought the Jedi weren't allowed such relationships."
That wrung an ironic half-grin out of me. "Guess I'm not allowed, then."
"It certainly explains the coincidence. It must have been your father of whom my uncle spoke. Apparently, this Skywalker saved his life at the Battle of Sedratis. They were swarmed by droid fighters, and my uncle's shields were depleted when Skywalker flew in between him and the next blast that would have killed him. Skywalker destroyed the immediate threat and gave Ho'ulik's shields a chance to recharge. They were eventually victorious that day, and I'm given to understand that they fought together on several occasions."
That was the first specific exploit of my father's career as a Jedi I'd ever heard. It was gratifying to hear of him saving the life of a friend. Thank you for sharing that.
"Did your father survive the Clone Wars?"
Sunta asked.
"No.
I said, shaking my head. He was betrayed by Darth Vader.
I am sorry to hear. But how do you know that specifically?
I was told so by another Jedi, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Kenobi? I know that name. He came to Rodia during the Clone Wars to help return a kidnapped child from another clan. Am I to understand he's still alive?
For a moment, I felt my throat close up. But then I was able to say, not anymore. He died at the Battle of Yavin.
Ah, so a Jedi was involved in the destruction of the Death Star. The Alliance's victory there makes much more sense now. The Jedi have a way of turning daunting tasks into routine ones.
I decided not to mention that I'd been the one who delivered the fatal shot to the exhaust port. Besides, Obi-Wan had helped me. So, what happened to your uncle? I asked.
Like your father, he was betrayed. He was shot by clone troopers who were supposed to be on his side. He made it into his ship, recorded a brief message about what happened to him with his astromech, and gave it orders to bring him back here. He could not think of any place safer in the entire galaxy, which I thought was sad. This has never been a safe planet. But he was already dead when his ship landed. His wounds too severe to survive the journey.
That's terrible. I'm sorry, I said. Did his astromech survive the trip?
Only in the physical sense. The clan wiped its memory to prevent it falling into the wrong hands and putting us at risk. We scuttled his ship and built my uncle a small tomb out in the jungle, not knowing what else to do.
Oh, I don't suppose it would be... Well, look, Sunta, that was a lightsaber you saw on my belt. One left for me by my father. And I'd like to be a Jedi myself someday, if I can. If it's not rude of me to ask, do you think I could go pay my respects to your uncle? The antennae on top of Sunta's head, they look like suction cups on short stalks, drew back in what I thought must be surprise. Or maybe it was shock and a certain sense of outrage. I'm not well schooled in Rodian body language, and my shoulders tensed, bracing for an angry retort. Instead, Sunta sounded pleased.
That would be most thoughtful of you. I should pay my own in any case.
Sunta took a sip from her calf cup and then said,
You're a prospective customer. We can borrow a couple of speeders by way of a test drive and visit now if you'd like. The tomb isn't far from here.
That sounds great, I said. I'm actually not hungry. We can go now if you're willing.
So be it.
Leaving the quiet solarium and crossing the length of Uthiel Outfitters was at once refreshing and uncomfortable.
It was nice to walk in open surroundings instead of in subterranean tunnels or the close confines of a ship. But manufacturing facilities are not renowned for their peace and quiet. Welding and the whir of machinery assailed our ears, and the vibrations of shearing metal shook our bones to the point that I began to miss the silence of space. Tanich Sunta spoke to the warehouse supervisor and secured two brightly colored demo speeder bikes for a day trip. We shot north into the tangle of the jungle, slicing through the wet air as if we were water skiing. I followed Sunta's lead, weaving through trees just below the canopy and above the undergrowth. The humidity was truly ridiculous, and I felt the close pressure of it even with the wind of the ride. Sweat trickled down my neck and back. My clothes stuck to my skin, and I resigned myself to marinating. The dry heat on Tatooine felt like being in an oven sometimes, but this was more like bathing in a stew pot. After we flew over the canyon I recognized as the one that led to the smuggling bay, we descended for a click until the trees stopped growing so close and poor drainage maintained a swamp of dark water frosted with green algae. It wasn't an endless expanse of water, however. Small islands of spongy loam peeked out of the swamp, providing places for trees and bushes to take root. And Tsunta led me to one of the boasted some solid rock on it. Only a little bit was available on the edge. The island was so choked with trees and thick undergrowth, there was truly nowhere else to land. I didn't see the mausoleum until we sat down on a moss-covered stone shelf a mere half a meter above the swamp. It was a small stone structure hidden under the canopy of a thinek tree and further camouflaged by creeping vines. Before the whir of our speeder repulsors faded, Tsunta urged me to dismount quickly. The stress in her voice jarred against the languid croaking of frogs and the bored conversation of alien birds.
"We should move away from the water's edge," Tsunta said, "just in case there may be guests nearby."
"Guests?"
"Yes,"
she said, putting her hand on the small of my back and gently ushering me away from the speeders and into a thicket of bushes that dared me to pass through without getting stabbed and scratched by thorns.
"They're large creatures that like to move quietly in the water before erupting to pluck food off the shorelines, especially herbivores and birds. And we just flew down from the sky to land at the shore."
Tsunta's sentence was cut off as an enormous scaled figure splashed out of the swamp and pounced on my speeder bike, wrapping it up with clawed hands and biting down into the front steering vanes with a mouthful of sharp teeth. We scrambled back as the guest roared, frustrated to find it had ambushed something that was not meat. And it slammed the speeder into the rock shelf with its powerful arms, destroying the vanes in the process and effectively totaling the vehicle. The guest turned its pale, round eyes on us and hissed as it slipped back into the water, disappearing completely, leaving us with thudding hearts in our chests and a single working speeder.
"Your point is well taken," I said.
"Will it try again?" "When we try to leave, yes, there is no doubt," Tsunta said. "It prefers ambush. It knows the speeders are not food now, but that we are. It will be watching."
I noticed that there was no way for us to watch the guest in return. The swamp water revealed nothing of what moved underneath the surface.
"Can we shoot it?" I asked. "Yes, but it is notoriously difficult to get off a lethal shot before a guest bites you in half. They are not hunted so often as they used to be, but when they are hunted in teams, and those teams often return with a dead guest and at least one dead Rodian."
"It won't come after us on the land?"
"It's technically possible, but highly doubtful. Guests are much slower on land and perceive that as a weakness. They prefer the quick strike."
We stood in silence for a couple of minutes, looking for any signs of movement in the dark waters. The surface remained still and gave no hint that something stalked us from below. During that time, it occurred to me that this had been horrible planning on Tsunta's part.
Why did we land so close to shore? "There was no place else to land. You saw that for yourself as we came in."
"So you risk an attack like that every time you visit your uncle's final resting place?"
"Hardly ever. Someone in the family clears a path and landing area each time we visit. But the jungle is robust. New growth shoots up, and it's been too long since anyone visited. I might have been the last one to visit, and that was almost a standard year ago.
So how are we getting back?
We'll have to double up on my speeder.
I gestured at the still waters where the guest waited.
But that thing would never let us get off the ground. You can't call for someone to come get us?
I know from experience that my comm won't reach anyone from this place.
What about an emergency beacon?
The Rhodian gave that single twitch of her head to the left that meant no.
These demonstration models are stripped down, built for speed rather than safety. Our clients always want a demonstration of speed, but never ask for a demonstration of emergency services.
I sighed in frustration. Well, let's do what we came to do, and worry about getting out of here afterward, I said.
Agreed, Sunta said.
Then we turned to the mausoleum.
Sunta produced a handheld sonic cutter to clear a path through the undergrowth, which allowed us to reach it in a few minutes, while saving our clothes and skin from tears and perhaps puncture wounds. The mausoleum didn't have a marker on it, or any engraving explaining who was entombed there. Sunta knelt in the soft dirt before the gray stone door, and I joined her, bowing my head. She said a few things in her native language that I didn't understand, but they sounded solemn and respectful, and I hoped my silence would be taken in the same spirit. But I could not help wondering what might lie inside the tomb. I know that Sunta said her uncle's body had been found inside his ship once it landed, but was it truly still there now? I don't think I'll ever forget the sight of Obi-Wan's empty robe. That method of dying still didn't seem plausible to me, and I had seen it with my own eyes. I wondered if perhaps this Ha'ulik had eventually faded to nothingness in the same way. When Sunta had finished her oblations, I asked, "Forgive me if it's rude to ask, but might we see him?" The Rhodian tilted her head ever so slightly in my direction and regarded me with her giant black eyes.
"Did you speak the truth earlier? Do you wish to become a Jedi yourself one day? Or was that merely an idle fantasy?"
"Yes, I truly wish it, more than anything."
"Then we should enter."
I helped her open the door, and the smell inside was every bit as damp and moldy as the outside. Assorted slugs and a snake wriggled away from the sudden glare of sunlight. A sarcophagus squatted in the middle of the room, almost covered in a carpet of lichen.
"There's something in there for you," Sunta said, pointing with a green finger.
There is?
What? Help me move the lid.
I didn't argue, since it was what I wanted anyway, but her eagerness puzzled me. I supposed I didn't know much about Rhodian cultural taboos regarding the dead, and decided to go with it. We hefted a corner of the slab together and shoved it aside until the top half of Ha'ulik's remains lay revealed. There wasn't much left, but clearly he hadn't passed on to some other state of existence like Obi-Wan. Apart from the bones, there were still fragments of the robe left. A few curling clumps of hardy threads that had survived this long against the elements and denizens of the swamp. Sunta leaned over and thrust her hand into the sarcophagus, obstructing my view. She emerged holding a thick black cylinder.
"This is Ha'ulik's lightsaber, I believe. We buried it with him since we didn't know what else to do with it."
"Does it still work?"
"I don't know."
She handed it to me.
"Try it and see. It's yours."
I blinked. "You're giving this to me? Wouldn't someone else in your family object?"
Sunta shrugged her antennae.
At this point, I suspect I am the only member of my family who still comes to visit him. And it is not doing any good sealed away like that. I think it's an inheritance better suited to you than me. Perhaps you can learn something from it, and one day become a Jedi like your father and my uncle. It would be good to have the Jedi return, I think.
It was a stupefying gift, and I had difficulty mustering a response. Thank you, I managed after a time, though the words were inadequate. I'm honored. Ulic's lightsaber was designed for a Rodian hand, and wasn't quite comfortable in my fist. It had a matte black finish to it, and an odd, slick feeling. I didn't know if that was its original state, or if some kind of biological ooze coated it. Pointing it carefully away from both of us, I thumbed it on, expecting the power cell to be long depleted by now. But it ripped into life, and thrummed with energy. A brilliant amethyst blade.
Now, something like that, Sunta said, might allow you to survive a direct attack from a guest.
It took a moment for me to process her meaning, but when I did, I stared at her. You mean walk out there as bait, holding a lightsaber in front of me?
You have two now, correct? Your odds of ensuring the guest has to eat a lightsaber before it eats you are pretty good.
I grinned. Sunta had a strange sense of humor, but she also had a point. I'd be better off protecting myself from a quick attack with two lightsabers than with a single blaster that I'd have to aim and fire in a fraction of a second before I got chomped. I thumbed off the Rodian lightsaber and asked, I don't suppose Ulic brought anything else home with him, like a handy step-by-step manual on how to train yourself to become a Jedi?
No, nothing like that, unfortunately. I would have attempted it myself, had that been the case, even though I can't feel the Force.
Well, I'm very grateful for this much. I turned the lightsaber hilt over in my hands, thinking. You said he was shot by his own clone troopers?
That was what his recording said. We, of course, had no way to confirm it. Asking the local garrison of troopers if someone may have shot a Rodian Jedi Knight off-planet would attract the wrong sort of attention. But it's stunning in its implications, isn't it? Looked at in that light, it might have been the Jedi who were betrayed, not the Emperor.
Not for the first time. I wished I'd had more time with Ben. Not only could he have taught me about the Force, but he could have filled in many giant gaps in my knowledge regarding the history of the Clone Wars. The Empire's version of events was undoubtedly self-serving, but there was no alternative version of events available. My aunt and uncle would never talk to me about it, no matter how much I begged them. I felt handicapped by my ignorance. You've given me a lot to think about. That is, if I can get us out of here. Even if Sunta were to leave me here to go get help, she'd need to get on her speeder bike safely. And there was no guarantee she could do that. If the guest was still waiting in the swamp, it could easily pounce before she could take off. We needed to remove the threat before either of us tried to mount the speeder bike. I withdrew my own lightsaber from my belt, walked forward to the edge of the island, one weapon in each hand, and turned them both on. I crouched to minimize myself as a target as I advanced, holding the lightsabers parallel to the ground and angled to protect each side of me so that I was at the base of a triangle. The guest would have to be extremely fast and agile to take me out without getting cut. The problem was,
and it looked like it might actually be that fast and agile. The dark water gave no sign of the guest's whereabouts, only a promise that it hit a food chain within its depths, and I was not at the top of it. Just stepping near the water made me feel like something's lunch. Insects and birds and amphibians continued to drone and chirp and croak, heedless of my problems. But their noise existed on another level than auditory. When I stretched out with my feelings and tried to locate the guest through the force, all I got was an overwhelming sense of the life surrounding me. Nothing so specific as a single bird or fish or predator. I knew that many of the creatures were hungry and wanted to eat other creatures, but there was no sense that a certain one wished to eat me. There I stood, shifting my weight a bit and moving slightly to look alive, lightsabers humming, for 5 full minutes. "Maybe it's moved on," I finally said. "How about you try taking the remaining speeder back? I'll guard you as you get on and come back to pick me up." Sunta said, "I suppose." And then the guest erupted from the swamp on my left, a flash of movement faster than I could track. By reflex, I whipped the blade in my left hand toward it, while simultaneously falling backward and swinging a fraction later with my right hand as well. Both swings connected, but the guest connected too. Its head got above and through my awkward defenses, and it sank its teeth into the soft tissue between my left shoulder and my neck. It didn't bite through or try to move up to my throat, however. By the time we hit the ground, its head and shoulders weren't connected to the rest of the body. The swing I'd taken with my lightsaber had shorn through entirely, leaving me alive, but with a dead guest's teeth buried in my flesh. Sunta rushed over to help.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"I'll live, I think."
"Most people don't survive being attacked, so that was well done."
The soggy head affixed to my body didn't make me feel like a winner. Ugh. It wasn't really a skill thing. More like panicked reflexes and really good weapons. You were right. There's no way I would have gotten off a blaster shot in time. I thumbed off the lightsabers and shook a little bit from adrenaline and the thought of how close I'd come to death. A couple of centimeters more and the guest would have had my throat, and I would have bled out regardless. The guest's jaws hadn't locked up, so prying it loose was more painful than difficult.
"We need to get you to the infirmary," Sunta said, tossing the head into the swamp before helping me to my feet.
The guest's long serpentine body trailed off into the water, a greenish log that ended in blood on the rock.
"The sooner the better. Limping into town doubled up on the speeder will be a bit faster than going back for another one and returning."
She took hollows of the damaged speeder and the guest's body with her data pad before we left.
"I need to explain what happened if I don't want to have my pay docked."
We crowded onto the remaining speeder. I wrapped my right arm around Sunta's waist and did my best to deal with her personal pungency. I knew that later I'd look back on the experience and count it as a good one on the whole, because there was no telling what I could learn from Ha'ulik's lightsaber. But at the time, feeling weak and lightheaded from blood loss, foul smells, and excessive humidity, I thought that was the worst speeder ride ever.